This meeting is now being recorded.
So Kate Rubin is here from Harvard. She's a Clay Fellow there. And before that, she was a postdoc at MPIA working with Joe Hanawi. Before that, she was a grad student with Xavier Prochaska and David Koo at UCSC, University of California, Santa Cruz. And she's here with us today to tell us about the circumgalactic media. Medium.
There can be media. Okay. yeah, it's great to be here and have this opportunity to share some recent results on diffuse gas in galaxy environments. So among other results, I'll present two projects that I'm leading in collaboration with these people listed here. So there will be kind of two parts to my talk. The first part is done in collaboration with Rob Simcoe, Xavier Prochaska, Joe Hanawi, Neil Crichton, and Simeon Burr, just down the road. And then the second part is done in collaboration with Alex Diamond-Stanek and Allison Coyle. So before I start, I just wanted to recommend, I haven't read this book. It's to show you that my title isn't totally random. It's actually Lineland of Labyrinth. Lineland of Labyrinth. But anyway, there was a typo in some of the talk ads. But yeah, so this is a satire on the class structure of Victorian society, and the main character and narrator is a square, and he lives in Flatland. So this is the original cover, and then a more modern cover might look like.
Read that one.
Yeah. It's a good one. Okay. Anyway, okay, so for measurements of the CMB power spectrum, we now know how many baryons there are in the universe. But one of the most fundamental problems of modern astrophysics is that we've lost track of a pretty significant fraction of these baryons at the current epoch. So we're good with this small fraction of the baryons. About 6% of the baryons are locked in stars and are very clearly evident in the luminous structures of galaxies. Now, we might naively assume that many of the remaining baryons are in the vicinity of these stars, you know, tracing the dark matter overdensities which host these galaxies. But, as I'm sure you all are familiar with, we can get a better idea to kind of calibrate our expectations for how many baryons galaxies ought to have. We can just consider the mass of the dark matter halos, which are hosting the galaxies, and compare the fraction of their mass in stars with the cosmic baryon fraction, which is shown up there with the green line. But when we do that, we see that galaxies still fall well short of their halos' cosmic allocation of baryons. So, just to get a little bit more specific here, let's consider a halo of just one mass, say a halo similar to the one hosting our own galaxy. So that has a mass of about 10 to the 12 solar masses. Now, by today, about 15% of the baryons belonging to this halo have formed into stars, and another 10% are in cool gas dust in the ISS of the galaxy. Recent quasar absorption line experiments done by the done by the COS HALOS team have now demonstrated that the regions extending to 160 kiloparsecs from galaxies like this one contain at least 30% and perhaps the remaining baryons belonging to this halo. So that's the majority of the baryons, actually, the majority of the cosmic allocation of baryons for this halo. So we know exactly, you know, what the 25% of baryons right here in this halo look like. They look like this. We now have thousands of images of galaxies, but we have very little idea what the majority of the baryons in this halo we do know a little something about what the CGM looks like, at least around special galaxies in pretty extreme environments. So this is a good example. This is maybe our best image of a circumgalactic medium. And this is a special galaxy because it's a starburst galaxy, M82. It has a very high spatial concentration of star formation activity. And here we're seeing this disk edge on. And all of that star formation activity is driving a powerful outflow of gas. And that gas is being shocked and is emitting in the alpha transition, which is in this, as well as in the soft X-ray, which is blue. And so this highlights a potential mechanism behind actually the low fraction of baryon stars, and that is feedback driven by star formation and supernova. And we can also image the CGM in certain types of environments at redshift 2 and beyond in the Lyman alpha transition. In particular, Lyman alpha nebulae or blobs like this one can exhibit very bright and beautiful Lyman alpha emission. I think the definition of a blob is that it has to extend at least 50 kiloparsecs on the sky. And this is an example. This is data taken with the MUSE spectrograph on the VLT of a Lyman alpha nebula at a redshift of 4. And so these blobs are thought to occupy quite massive halos, maybe 10 to the 13th solar mass dark matter halos at high redshift. So these are quite extreme environments. And in addition, the mechanism which is illuminating this gas is not yet well understood. So we do know what the CGM looks like in extreme cases, but for more typical galaxies, sub-L star or L star galaxies, we have to go after this gas in absorption. It is too faint to image in emission with current technology, at least. And so, for instance, if you wanted to, you could use the stars in the galaxy in a galaxy as a background light source against which you could probe gas along the line of sight in absorption. And so such studies have focused on the kinematics of the gas close to the galaxy, of course, sensitive to all the gas along the line of sight, but we expect the signature to be dominated by the motion of the densest gas close to the galaxy. And this is an example from one such study. This is from Ben Wiener. And he examined magnesium 2 absorption at a rest wavelength of 2800 angstroms. Magnesium 2 is sensitive to cool photoionized gas at about 10,000 degrees Kelvin. Here, the systemic velocity of galaxies is shown with the vertical lines. And here he's showing us a coad of about 1,000 galaxy spectra. And so you can see that the magnesium 2 absorption in those spectra is shifted blueward of systemic velocity, indicating that the gas is moving towards us with respect to the galaxy's motion, meaning that this gas is flowing out of a galaxy, just as we saw in the case of M82. So such studies have demonstrated that it's not only extreme galaxies like M82 that have these winds. A common feature of basically all L-star and slightly sub-L-star star-forming galaxies, at least between redshifts 0.5 to 1, where this has been explored. So we know a little bit of something, a little bit about what the diffuse gas around is doing, but there is so much more to learn. So now let us pursue an image of the typical galaxy circumgalactic medium. And again, by typical, I mean CGM around an L star or sub-L star galaxy. And again, this stuff is too faint to image with current technology. So we know that about 20% of the baryons are in the disk. Perhaps the rest of the baryons are in the circumgalactic medium. We know that these galaxies are driving winds. We know that's a typical feature of these galaxies. And we also can get a pretty good idea of the rate of gas inflow onto these halos that's kind of set by cosmology. It's basically just a function of the halo mass and the redshift. So we can get an estimate of that aspect of the gas flow through these halos quite well. But we need to complete this picture. So to complete our theoretical model, first of all, we want to know the physical impact of the winds around these galaxies. We want to know how far they actually extend from their host. Ideally, we'd like to know whether the winds can actually escape from their host galaxies. And then second of all, what does this gas actually look like once it gets out into the circumgalactic medium? For instance, is cool gas in the circumgalactic medium distributed in many tiny bullets? Or does it have kind of a more diffuse distribution? Is it distributed in more cloud-like structures? So those are some aspects that I like to focus on today regarding the structure of the CGM around these galaxies. And of course, there are other quantities of interest. It would be great, for instance, to know the rate at which this gas is moving back towards onto the galaxy. CGM gas would be moving back and provide fuel for future star formation, for instance. Okay, so we're going to explore how we can constrain this typical galaxy CGM image. And we're going to do that today using two experiments. And so now I will tell you about the first experiment. Tracing neutral hydrogen and metals through galaxy environments at redshift 2. So we're going to redshift 2 somewhat for convenience purposes, but we also expect it to be a pretty exciting time in for the CGM around galaxies. It was the peak in cosmic star formation activity after all, and we expect that cosmic star formation activity to be accompanied by a quite high rate of gas inflow onto the galaxies, and perhaps gave rise to quite powerful outflows of gas from these objects as well. So we expect to see something exciting at least around the CGM of such systems. So to do this, we just need to accomplish two steps. We need to find some galaxies at redshift 2. Of course, they're surrounded by some CGMs. And we want them, because this stuff is safe, we want to study it in absorption. And so we want these galaxies to be close on the sky to a background source, a bright background source. So if we can use the spectrum of it to probe foreground gas in absorption. So two steps, and we're done. But of course, this gets a little bit complicated. So these steps have been accomplished so far by searching the fields around very bright quasars in emission for galaxies in the foreground. So this is one example of such a field. This is a quasar, bright quasar at redshift 3. And Neil Crichton has taken an image of the field with LBT. He's used three colors here, and he's searched the field to try to identify objects with which have colors consistent with being a Lyman break galaxy at redshift 2. So does anyone want to guess where the Lyman break galaxy at redshift 2 is? Okay, this isn't really working. It's right here. This tiny faint blob is a Lyman break galaxy.
It's not red.
Huh? It's supposed to be blue, right?
Depends. Is it dropping? It should be dropping out of the
Just stop dropping out.
The colors are.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Hard to do out of an RGB image. Keep going.
Yeah, you are always.
Yeah.
Okay, so this. So Neil selected this galaxy, and then he did some very deep follow-up spectroscopy to identify, to confirm the redshift of the galaxy that he selected, and this one happens to be at redshift 2.2, and a projected separation of 80 kiloparsecs from the quasar. And this is exciting because there really are not many of these four-bound galaxies known so close to bright quasars. And I think the total sample of one of the bright galaxies within 200 kiloparsecs of quasars is about 50. So this, while it definitely can work and it has built, has been used to build up quite a large sample of these foreground Lyman Ray galaxies, in particular, with work led by Chuck Seidel and Gwen Rudy. It nevertheless is quite expensive. You can see that these galaxies are really big. So we'll keep that in mind for later. But we've learned quite a bit about such studies, or from such studies, about the CGM around Lyman Ray galaxies. So this is just kind of one summary plot showing some of what we've learned. So this is showing median optical depth as a function of transverse distance from the foreground Lyman Ray galaxy in a few different transitions. So just focus on the black line. That's showing you the median optical depth in Lyman alpha, or in H1, sorry. And you can see that H1 optical depth is elevated well above the average level in the intergalactic medium out to a distance of 2 megaparsecs. That's the H1. Also focus over here on the carbon-4. That's the orange line. And you can see that is also elevated above the average level in the intergalactic medium out to at least a megaparsec. So these galaxies are surrounded by over-densities of neutral hydrogen, which is also metal-enriched over quite large scales. So we've learned quite a bit about the CGM around these systems. And this is kind of putting that work in context of it. So this is a luminosity function for galaxies at redshift 2. Lyman Ray galaxies are selected down to about this absolute magnitude limit. They have halo masses of approximately 10 to the 12 solar masses. There's also been some work led by Prochaska and Hanali on the CGM around quasar-host halos. And so they tend to occupy slightly more massive dark matter halos, masses about 10 to the 12.5 solar masses. And so they kind of take care of the brighter area of the luminosity function. But you see, there are a lot more galaxies, a lot more faint galaxies, and they have not been accessible with the techniques that have been used so far by selecting galaxies in emission. So how can we actually access the environment of these less luminous systems? That's the question. And the answer is to search for them in absorption as well. So, if you have a quasar at redshift 3, and that sight line passes through or close to the disk of a galaxy at redshift 2, then that will give rise to a very high column density neutral hydrogen absorption system called a damped Lyman alpha system. So that is a system with a neutral hydrogen column density of at least 10 to the 20.3 particles per square centimeter. And here's a quasar, towards which a damped Lyman alpha system is detected. You can see they're quite easy to identify because of the large, the broad damping wing. And so if you have a quasar spectrum and you see this along the line of sight, then you can be reasonably confident that that sight line is passing close to a galaxy. Now that galaxy has some kind of CTM around it, certainly. And so if you know about another quasar close to the first on the sky, but also behind the galaxy CTM system, then a spectrum of that quasar will tell you about the CTM of this foreground galaxy. So that's the experiment we're going to do. So you might wonder, you know, what kind of galaxies are we really selecting when we go after them, when we use their CLA absorption to identify them. And I'll tell you right now, we are never going to know what these particular DLA galaxies actually look like. And that this kind of shows you why. So this is a DLA absorption trough here. And these authors have identified this blip of emission as Lyman alpha arising from that DLA host galaxy. You can see they feel confident because the trace of the Lyman alpha in that location is a little bit offset from the quasar trace. You can see that up here. And so that Lyman alpha emission corresponds to a star formation rate of about 10 solar masses per year. And I believe they also detect H-alpha emission from the same object. They say that this galaxy has a 10th O star Lyman alpha emission, H-alpha emission. So this one, this is a very faint galaxy, redshift 2. DLA host galaxies aren't always so faint. And so this is another example. This is a star with a DLA along the site. It happens that this blob here has the same redshift as that DLA. And this is actually quite a bit brighter. It has a star formation rate of 30 solar masses per year. So that's much more similar to a Lyman break galaxy type star formation rate.
I'm just trying to understand. Yeah. So 10 solar masses, sorry, star formation rate is 10 solar masses per year, and I'm trying to synchronize that with the 10th L star H alpha. That seems off.
You think it's too high?
So 10 solar masses, so sorry, what is L? Maybe I don't understand what L star H alpha is. What is L star H alpha in that?
At redshift 2.
The H-alpha luminosity function at redshift 2 has a knee at 100 solar masses per year?
I thought
it was a bit more slower, but it was closer to like 70 or 80 or something. But it's within the range.
Okay.
Yeah,
so it's within the range? Okay.
I can double check on me.
I mean, that's all. So it's a tenth of a Euler.
Maybe they don't know. I don't know what L-star is at redshift 2 for H-alpha. Because it requires, was that a near-infrared narrowband imaging survey?
I mean, I'm just looking at the same 10 solar masses per year is a healthy star formation rate. It's 10 times the delays, right?
Yeah.
But, okay. Okay, I guess I'm surprised that's too small to see. Okay.
Right, so, I mean, that's too small to see in this context. I mean, if you were looking for this galaxy in an image, never be able to separate.
Oh, there's also a quasar on top of it. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So that's part of the problem, too. So work that Mark has been involved in has actually assessed the average UV emission from DLA host galaxies. And they find that on average, at least, DLAs have to have a very low star formation rate, less than 2 solar masses per year. But at the same time, there has been a measurement of the bias of DLAs, which suggests that that at least some DLAs arrive in halos with masses exceeding 10 to the 12 solar masses. So these pieces of evidence seem somewhat inconsistent with each other, but it turns out they can be reconciled. Vivian Bird has studied the incidence. showing us the incidence as a function of halo, dark matter halo mass. The different colors show different feedback recipes used in various realizations of these simulations. And you can see that the incidence kind of peaks at 10 to the 10.5. It moves it, you know, the minimum mass for DLA is around 10 to the 9. The maximum is a little bit above 10 to the 12. And with this distribution of DLAs, this is actually consistent with this bias measurement assistance. And so really, when we search for DLAs in this way, we're selecting galaxies over a quite wide range of halo masses, but they tend to have masses between about 10 to the 10 and 10 to the 11th solar masses, at least according to Simeon. So now we kind of know what we're looking at here, so we just need some pairs of quasars, and Joe Hanali is an expert at selecting such pairs from Sloan and Voss imaging spectroscopy. Here is one example. This is a Sloan image of a pair at redshift 2.1. These quasars are separated by about 60 kiloparsecs. This is a spectrum of the green quasar up here. You can see Lyman alpha, or the DLA that we detected along the line of sight here at redshift 2 and associated metal absorption lines. And then here is the other quasar spectrum. Here's Lyman alpha absorption at the same redshift, as well as some strong metalline absorption at that redshift. So we're detecting a metal-enriched circumgalactic medium at 60 kiloparsecs in projection from this DLA host galaxy. And so we now have a sample of about 40 such quasar pairs with intervening DLAs, so that we can study a larger sample of these systems. So this is what their CGM looks like. So this is neutral hydrogen, the column density of neutral hydrogen as a function of impact parameter from those DLAs. So the cyan points show optically thick systems, optically thick in neutral hydrogen, and the upper limits show sight lines where we're not sure if we're actually seeing optically thick neutral hydrogen or not. These are actually double DLAs, so where we have systems where we have DLAs along both lines of sight. So this gives us a lower limit on the covering fraction of neutral hydrogen around these systems. You can see it varies from about 20 to 40% out to 150 kiloparsecs. Just for comparison, this is the incidence of optically thick neutral hydrogen around Lyman Bank galaxies, measured by Gwen Rudy. You can see they're quite consistent. And here, just for comparison, is the incidence of optically thick neutral hydrogen around quasar host galaxies. That's the same
amount. And I have a dumb question. Optically thick to what? Optically thick to what kind of radiation? Like ionizing radiation?
Oh, yes. This is optically thick at the Lyman limit. So greater than 10 to the 17.2 particles. That's the only, That's not a dumb question. Okay, so now we can look at the average H1 absorption strength in the system. So this is the redshift of the DLA sample versus impact parameter of the quasar sight lines. So I'm going to just stack now the Lyman alpha coverage of these few sight lines within 50 parsecs. Here is that stack of the co-out of the Lyman alpha coverage out to 50 kiloparsecs. We detect quite strong absorption in that area of and we can step out in distance, out to 100 kiloparsecs.
We can say so. Does it bother you? I can.
Folks that are online, can you please mute your microphones? We hear someone typing and maybe chattering in their office. So please mute your microphone if you're calling in. Thank you.
And so we can step out, and we see we start to lose the absorption signal out beyond 200 kilohertz. And here, just for fun, we see the average DOA profile for all of the systems.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing star 6.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm shutting them down. Okay. but they can chat. They can type.
They can type in the question, and we can unmute them at the end of your talk. If you have a question, press star 6 to unmute your phones, and then you can ask it.
So this is the average Lyman alpha equivalent width as a function of impact parameter. You can see it declines with impact parameter, and we start to place an upper limit here at about 230 kiloparsecs. So now we can again compare with Lyman ray galaxies and quasars, and you can see we're again quite consistent with the equivalent width measured around Lyman ray galaxies as shown with the red points. Again, the quasars exhibit much stronger absorption. And then finally, we can look at the metal absorption strength around the system. So this is the equivalent width of carbon 4 as a function of projected separation. Carbon 4 traces a kind of warmer gas. It may be photoionized, may be collisionally ionized at temperatures of more like 10 to the 5 Kelvin. And so you can see we detect some quite strong systems out to 150 kiloparsecs in this metal-enriched gas, carbon-4. We can also look at the equivalent width of low ionization lines. So this is, again, probing cool photoionized gas at around 10 to the 4 Kelvin. And you can see its absorption is quite a bit weaker. We almost only see low ionization absorption, where we also see a double DLA. So that's those points outlined in cyan. And just to remind you, the virial radius of a Lyman ray galaxy is supposed to be about 90 kilohertz. So we're looking at metal-enriched gas well beyond the virial radius of these galaxies. And so we can look at the covering fraction of this enriched material. For carbon-4, we find a covering fraction of about 60% out to 100 kiloparsecs. In low ionization lines, we find a covering fraction of only 20% out to 100 kiloparsecs. And again, most of these systems are in double DLA. So now, can just kind of, there seems to be a lot of carbon-4 out there around these systems, and we can get a very rough estimate of the amount of mass that the CEM contains in carbon. If we assume that the mass is given by this equation, we assume a covering fraction of a half, that the carbon-4 extends to about 100 kiloparsecs, and if we assume a fiducial column density for the covering for the carbon-4 systems of about 10 to the 14, we find that these CGMs have to contain about 5 times 10 to the 5 solar masses of carbon. So we can then compare that number to the mass in carbon that we expect to be in the DLAs. So if we're assuming that they have stellar masses of about 2 times 10 to the 9 and metallicities of minus 1.5, then we find that they contain about 10 to the 4 solar masses worth of carbon. And so, you know, this is very uncertain, just a back of the envelope type of thing, but it shows that the CGM contains a significant reservoir of carbon already at this
the bottom one is assuming that it's bound up within the galaxy. The total mass in DLA carbon, is that within the galaxy? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
This is a comparison of what's in the CGM versus what's within the viral radius in the galaxy. galaxy?
Well, much smaller than the Burial radius.
Much more, okay.
Yeah. So just in
the optical disk.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay. And then finally, this is average equivalent width versus intact parameter. Again, you already saw this plot for the case of Lyman alpha. Here it is for carbon 2 and carbon 4. And so the DLA measurements are again in white. In both of these panels, Lyman break galaxy measurements are in red. And so again, at this fidelity, have somewhat limited fidelity with the data so far, but at this fidelity, the CGM of DLAs and the CGM of Lyman-Wright galaxies seem to have about the same metal absorption strength. And so we're comparing CGM across pretty different mass scales here. So DLAs have much lower mass halos. They have low star formation rates, less than 2. Lyman-Wright galaxies have much higher star formation rates, more like 20 to 50 solar masses per year. So, and they both have metal-enriched halos to basically the same level. And so it's been one idea for what's enriching the Lyman-Wright galaxy halo is that the metals have been driven out from the central galaxy by wind. But the DLAs have to have much weaker winds, and they have equal, at least according to, as well as we've measured so far, they have equal metal absorption rates in the CGM. So that suggests that perhaps the metals in both types of environments have been placed there by some other mechanism. The metals around Lyman-Wright galaxies do not have to have come from the central object. So let's take just a little bit closer look at that carbon-4 absorption. So here we have one system. So here are the two lines in the carbon-4 doublet. The DLA sight line in the system is in magenta. The CGM sight line is in white. And these sight lines are separated by about 70 kiloparsecs. And you can see that the absorption lies at basically the same velocity. This absorption is quite coherent over 70 kiloparsecs. Look at another example. Here, the carbon-4 absorption lines are a bit more complicated. The sight lines are separated by 50 kiloparsecs. But the central velocity of these two sight lines, carbon-4 in both sight lines, is about the same, and they are both similarly broad across quite a large distance. And we can look at the remaining absorption line profiles where we detect significant carbon-4 in the CGM. And you can see that these profiles are in general quite similar, and in some cases they lie right on top of each other. And so, if this carbon-4 were due to wind, again, we would expect that the velocity dispersion of that carbon-4 would be much larger close to the DLA. That's where the wind would be coming from. But we don't see that. We see much more quiescent kinematics on quite large scales, up to beyond 150 kiloparsecs. And so this has led us to argue that carbon-4, rather than being due to winds, has more quiescent kinematics and perhaps fills out a more filamentary structure for the gas. And so perhaps this carbon-4 was already there out in the CGM when these galaxies were forming, and it's simply falling onto the galaxy. And in fact, there's some evidence that the carbon-4 was out there well before redshift 2. This is one example. So this is from Dion. This star here shows a quasar sight line towards which a very strong carbon-4 absorber has been detected at a redshift of about 5. And so this left panel here shows the distribution of Lyman-Wright galaxies around that sight line, and they find that none of these Armagrave galaxies are within less than 10 co-moving megaparsecs over H from this strong carbon 4 observer at very high redshift. So it suggests that even at these very early times, this carbon 4 is not directly associated with winds from massive Lyman-Rate galaxies. It may be due to winds from lower mass systems, or perhaps was placed in the CGM at yet an earlier epoch. Okay, so we made some progress on our typical galaxy CGM here. We've seen that the cool gas, the photoionized gas, is located pretty close to the galaxy with a low covering fraction. It has a covering fraction of about 20% out to 100 kiloparsecs. We see that the warm carbon 4 absorbing gas is quite extended, however, and has quiescent kinematics. And I've argued that this CGM is likely not enriched by ongoing winds, even around more massive Lyman-Rate galaxies. Okay. So that's what we find from this CGM of DLA's experiment. Now, I will speak a bit about the coherence scale of the cool CGM. So now, we want to figure out, we're going to turn our attention to the cool photoionized gas in the CGM. We want to figure out its morphology. So is it smoothly distributed like this, or does it have a very tiny bullet-like structure, or perhaps it consists of a more diffuse cloud-like structure? And so we're going to, again, use bright background light sources to differentiate between these pictures, but we're going to move to redshift 0.5 for the moment, again, mostly for convenience purposes, actually. So we know a lot about the redshift 0.5 CGM already, and this plot kind of summarizes what we know. These are measurements taken from the literature. This is magnesium 2 equivalent width versus impact parameter. And of course, each of these sight lines is determined from an independent quasar galaxy projected pair. So this one would be from this background quasar floating this foreground galaxy halo, and this other point would be from this other background quasar probing another foreground galaxy halo. But when we collect all of these measurements together, we can get a statistical picture of what the magnesium 2 absorption looks like around a given population of foreground galaxies. And we see that, it's quite strong, close to the galaxies, out to about 50 kiloparsecs. And then it declines. Once you get beyond 50 kiloparsecs, we start to see a few more upper limits in the plot. So this work has used exclusively quasars as the bright background probes. But it turns out we actually have a few options. Now, quasars for these probes, quasars, just to put the beams in context for you a bit. The UV bright region of a quasar's accretion disk is a thousandth of a parsec. So that's the size of the beam that we're using when we study the foreground CGM with quasars. But we don't have to use quasars. We just need something bright in the blue. And so many people have focused on spectroscopy of stars, for instance, to probe the gas around our own galaxy. And stars, of course, have much smaller beams, more like 10 to the minus 7 parsecs. But there's no reason why we couldn't also use a galaxy as our background probe if it were bright enough. And of course, the galaxies have sizes of more like a kiloparsec at redshift 1. So now, quasars are easy because they're bright. And we already have all of this information about the CGM from quasars. But physical structure of the cool gas. So now let's focus in on the part of the CTM where we're almost guaranteed a detection of magnesium 2. And I'm just going to plot those equivalent widths within 50 kiloparsecs here in a histogram. So those are the same measurements. And now we're going to assume that every halo basically looks the same, that there's some fiducial galaxy halo, and that the variation in equivalent width from place to place on this plot is due to variations in equivalent width from place to place in that fiducial galaxy halo. So what does that halo look like? So now I've made a toy CGM. Sends out to 100 kiloparsecs, or sorry, 50 kiloparsecs, and I populated it with absorbers with an equivalent width given by this color bar here. And to do this, I had to choose some fiducial size for my absorbers. I think here I chose 100 parsecs. And I populated the toy CGM such that if I observed it with a bunch of background quasars, I would get the same equivalent width distribution that is actually observed. So this gives us the real observed equivalent width distribution, but the thing is, I made this other toy CGM over here. Here I've chosen a much smaller size for my absorbers, but if I observed this CGM with a bunch of background quasars, I would get exactly the same equivalent width distribution because quasars have such large beams. And I would get yet again the same equivalent width distribution if I observed this toy CGM with a bunch of background quasars. So how can we differentiate between these models? Here's a patch of CGM. It varies on some size scale, kind of the size of one of these red dots here. A quasar is always smaller than one of those dots. And this is the same distribution you've been seeing. I've just adjusted the y-axis. So if we actually knew about a type of background beam that was twice as large as this fiducial size, so if it looks like this, then I would get a different distribution of foreground equivalent width. I would lose the extremes in my distribution because the strongest absorbers in this patch would probably be located next to much weaker absorbers. And so the strongest absorbers would average down. So we would lose those strongest or largest equivalent widths. And then if I continue to increase the size of my background beam, I would continue to lose the extremes of my distribution until I'm basically only measuring the mean equivalent width over this patch. And so if we actually knew about a set of background beams that had a wide range of sizes, then we could actually do this experiment. And as it turns out, we do, because those background galaxies are a kiloparsec, whereas background quasars are a thousandth of a parsec, so there's a sixth order of magnitude difference between those beam functions. So we can do this experiment. All we need are some very bright blue galaxies at the right redshift, and we need them to be within 50 kiloparsecs in projection of a foreground galaxy of known redshift. So sometimes you can kind of stumble upon a pair of galaxies like this, and that's what happened back in 2010. This is one example of a galaxy pair in which the background galaxy at redshift 7 probes the halo of this foreground galaxy at redshift 0.5. So they have a projected separation of 17 kiloparsecs. Here's the spectrum of the background galaxy. The red lines show the magnesium 2 and iron 2 in self-absorption. And then you can see magnesium 2 and iron 2 at redshift 0.47 corresponds to many more strong absorption lines in that same spectrum. So that was cool, but this is actually really unusual. It's unusual to find such bright galaxies, especially so close to a bright foreground galaxy. so to do this systematically, you actually need a quite large and dense redshift survey, which was provided in the Primus redshift survey, which was led by Allison Coyle. And so this plot shows Primus stands for Prism Multi-Object Survey. It measured 120,000 redshifts over 900 degrees. And you can see this plot is just showing that it covers the largest volume and, you know, pretty much beats all of the other comparable surveys in terms of numbers of redshifts. So working with Allison and Alex Diamond-Stanek, we selected all of the pairs in Primus within 50 kiloparsecs where the background galaxies were bright enough to observe with Keck or the VLT in a couple of hours, where the foreground galaxies have the right redshift range and also bright enough to have secure redshifts. Here are some HST images of those galaxies. So some of them were in the Cosmos field. So the background galaxies are marked with a B, the foreground galaxies are marked with F. So this gives you a sense of what some of those background galaxy morphologies actually look like. Here is a star formation rate versus stellar mass diagram for the foreground galaxies. Those are in orange, and the contours show the underlying Primus sample. So this is just telling you that our galaxies are quite normal at this epoch, redshift 0.5. And then, so we observed these galaxies over 9 nights with Keck and the VLT on LRES and FORS 2. And here is some of our spectroscopy. So we observed 40 of those pairs. And then finally, from the galaxies with HST imaging, we were able to get nice constraints on the size of the background galaxies. And we find that they're almost all larger than about 2 kiloparsecs in effective radius. So these beams are at least 4 kiloparsecs that we're using. So here we see the magnesium 2 absorbing CGM but with background galaxy beams. So the white points are what you saw before, better toward background quasars. The magenta points are our new measurements toward background galaxies. You can see already that we detect some very strong absorption for those background galaxies. As strong as the strongest quasar absorbers measured in this sample. And so we find that these equivalent width distributions are statistically completely consistent with being drawn from the same distribution. So we find that this cool absorption has to vary on scales at least 4 kiloparsecs across. And so this gives us, I'll skip over this slide, but this gives us some measurement of the mass of the cloud, so a lower limit of about 4 times 10 to the 5 solar masses. At the same time, we expect that these clouds are moving through a very hot, million degree ambient medium in the CGM, and they are still, in spite of their mass, subject to Kelvin-Helmholtz and Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities. And if they have a quite low velocity relative to this medium of only 50 kilometers per second, we still expect them to be destroyed in only a couple hundred million years. So it remains to be understood how these clouds can actually survive as they pass through the hotter ambient circumgalactic medium. Well, we expect there to be a million degree phase to the circumgalactic medium, and we see some evidence for that hotter phase. I'll skip over this slide as well and say that you could do this a lot better with a UV-sensitive 12-meter space telescope. So the next generation ISU spectroscopic, UV-sensitive spectroscopic capability on this telescope, you could imagine taking spectra, spatially or independent spectra, of many UV-bright regions across the surface of a background galaxy, and then measuring absorption across that surface, sensitive to changes in it over very, very small scales. And with a UV-sensitive space telescope, we won't just be stuck with magnesium 2. We'll have access to many metal absorption transitions, as well as Lyman alpha and other hydrogen transitions. And so we'll be able to measure the metallicity on these very small scales across background galaxy types.
What's the resolving power?
Spatial or spectral?
Spectral. Well, to measure metallicity, I guess you'd want a resolution of 4,000 or greater. But then, of course, the next generation UV space telescope will also be able to actually just image the CGM around typical galaxies in emission in the Lyman alpha transition. So we'll be able to make images of these types of systems just as we've done with M82 and around Lyman alpha nebulae at high redshift. So we've learned something about the coherence scale of cool gas around DLA host star, or sorry, L-star galaxies at redshift 5. We've seen that it has to be coherent on scales of at least 4 kiloparsecs, but from our DLA study, we know that this cool gas is concentrated close to the galaxy. We've seen that warm carbon-4 absorbing gas extends over much larger scales and has quite quiescent kinematics, evocative of large-scale filaments rather than galactic winds, and we've finally seen that the CGM is likely not enriched by onboard winds. That's a bit repetitive, but yes, I think that about the DLA CGM as well as the Lyman-Rayet galaxy CGM. So we're well on our way to establishing an empirical model for the way that gas flows through galaxies. And future directions include upper limits on cloud size, which can be achieved from studies of lensed quasar sight lines, higher resolution spectroscopy of the quasar pair sight lines that I discussed for detailed constraints on metallicity and detailed kinematic measurements, and then final comparison of these quantities to cosmological simulations. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Some questions in the room first.
I had a question from your equivalent width versus, can you easily go back to the equivalent width versus the impact parameter for magnesium 2 plot?
Yeah.
That was a question, but it's not the question.
Yeah.
Okay. So I've been noodling around with LUVOIR sensitivities. And in addition to the case you gave where you can pinpoint regions separated over hundreds to thousands, hundreds of parsecs.
Mm.
You can also, for pretty much any galaxy down a couple magnitudes past L star, get at least that top line of equivalent widths of a 1, right, for anything in that line.
Okay.
For almost.
In emission or?
In either.
Sorry.
Just an equivalent width. So if you get the continued, you can down to like R of 25, R of 25 and a half, LUVOIR should be able to get a continuum measurement that's good enough to get an angstrom equivalent width. Right?
Ah, I see.
So I'm asking,
yes.
So if you can just imagine targeting every LBG down at R of 25 and a half in the field, you would get that measurement. And I'm wondering about how that would be, basically if you just made this a lot richer plot.
Oh, yes. Sure.
That's a different way. That's the large scale approach, and you talked
Absolutely.
About the small scale approach, but I'm wondering how to extend this kind of work where you got
I mean, you got
an equivalent width measurement for every LBG you could see in the field.
Absolutely. I mean, there are good going to be fewer. I guess I don't know how to think of those lima break. I guess I don't usually think of lima break galaxies being at low redshift. But that doesn't matter. As long as there are enough galaxies that are bright enough to observe,
there are, yes.
Then absolutely you could do this plot so much better.
We should talk about, and then what would you get out of that, is what I'm wondering, that you wouldn't get out of the in-depth down-the-barrel studies?
Well, I assume that, I mean, yeah, I assume that the in-depth down-the-barrel studies will be much more, I mean, you'll be able to do that over fewer background galaxies like mine.
Let me just try this.
All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing *6.
So I was just trying to unmute those folks that want to ask a question. If you have a question online, please press *6 to unmute yourself and then ask it. Hearing none, let's thank Kate one more time. That was a really great presentation.
To set up or join a sub-meeting, press the pound.